Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science. Whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere, we'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. Welcome back to the next episode of Deer University. And Steve, I guess we owe everybody an apology. It's been December was the last time we uploaded a podcast. And what can we say? Life's been busy. Life kind of happened, and we've just been busy with work and research and family and all that sort of thing. And I take a majority of the blame because I haven't demanded that you get into the put the headphones on and record a podcast with me. So, well, you don't take any of this blame. I will.
I will accept 50% of the blame because I could have pushed you to, hey, Bronson, we need to have another podcast.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
I like you taking some of the blame.
And I think both of us have thought about it a lot. Like, dang, we need to do another podcast.
Yep. Well, something brought the need to record a podcast to the forefront 1 week ago.
Yes, exactly.
Just seven short days ago.
Mm-hmm.
A little about 3 hours from where we are recording right now at about 10:30 a.m. And it was in the afternoon, probably 2 p.m. or 3 p.m. You and I are riding home from a meeting with biologists and landowners, and the news breaks that in Issaquena County, Mississippi, first documented case of chronic wasting disease. And so it begins for Mississippi. The saga continues nationwide, and specifically, our journey begins here in Mississippi. So, we're on day seven now of being a CWD-infected state. We got a lot of things, and Steve, we talked about. There's going to be many podcasts to come on this topic. So, what I really want to do, I want us to kind of chronicle our experience here. So we're right at the beginning, and every couple weeks I want us to do an update of what is happening, what it means for hunters, what it means for the deer herd. And so this is just episode number one of many to come. And what I wanted to accomplish with this episode is to more or less serve as the foundation for understanding the disease. So this is kind of MSU Deer Lab's audio file for a CWD fact sheet. What do you need to know?
Yeah. And let's put it into context. We have listeners in Mississippi that are certainly interested in what's happening in Mississippi, but this is not a new disease. It's been present for 40 or more years in some places, and half the states in the U.S. have exposure, and many of them have current populations of deer. So we're not going to just talk about what does this mean to Mississippi. We're going to be talking about what does this mean for other states in this fact sheet context.
Yeah.
And then as we move forward, we're going to be bringing in biologists and maybe some hunters from other states that have had it for a while. And you know, all right, you've been dealing with this for 2 or 3 years or for 20 or 30 years. What does it mean to you now, and how has your perception of this disease and how has its impact changed over time?
Yeah, to both the deer herd and to the hunters.
That's right.
We have two parties that are severely affected here. Number one, the deer. Number two, the hunters. Okay, Steve, that's a great segue into topic number one on my list is what's the history of CWD? And if you don't mind, why don't we start with what is it? CWD stands for chronic wasting disease. What is that disease?
Okay. It's caused likely by a protein called a prion. Now, it's important to people to understand a prion is a normal protein in all vertebrates that have a nervous system. And so we all have nerves that run from our brain, or well, our brain and spinal cord is basically a densely packed set of nerves. And then we have nerves running from our central nervous system, the brain and spinal cord, out to other parts that innervate our muscle and organs and various tissues. And they tell the muscles to do things. Every nerve has a portion of it that's insulated essentially by prions. Prions are kind of like an insulation material around a normal nerve. So they're critically important to the function of our nervous systems. A prion is a protein that is produced in the body and it's built from scratch from a bunch of amino acids. Now, healthy, normal prions do their job like they're supposed to. They insulate the axon of the nerve and, everything's fine. Now, the disease appears to be caused by a malformed or an abnormal protein that's built incorrectly. And it's like kind of like think of it as, well, it's a car where you've got three tires that are 17-inch rims and one tire that's a 12-inch rim. That car is not going to work very well driving down the highway. It's not functional. It's going to cause you problems. It's going to cause you to have an accident, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this misfolded or abnormal prion that is ingested by an animal, and it somehow, and we don't know how, it somehow causes the animal to start building the incorrect or abnormal prions and producing them instead of the healthy, normal prions. And over time, more and more cells are producing more and more of the abnormal prions instead of the normal ones. And so this architecture that is our nervous system, and in a deer's nervous system, it has to be restructured and rebuilt continuously over time. So as it's being rebuilt with new prions, the malformed or abnormal prions are put into the system instead of the healthy prions. And over time, that structure that is the nervous system is degenerated because it's built with faulty parts.
So is this similar. This is akin to, we could maybe use cancer as something where you're taking something completely normal in our body, but due to the replication of this abnormal, in this case, prion or abnormal protein, it builds and grows and accumulates, and then it reaches some threshold to where it's going to cause the animal severe problems.
It's a really good, similar. There, it's similar in process
in some ways
to a cancer.
What about, Steve? And this is something that still I don't understand: is how do they replicate? Is it that the prion is replicating, or the misshapen or malformed prion, or does it stimulate other prions to become malformed? Is that how that replication process begins and functions?
I don't know that it is currently well documented what that mechanism is. I'm sure there are people working on it, and maybe in a future podcast we'll be able to find those people and get a better description of this. But my understanding of cellular physiology is that somehow the abnormal prion gets into the cell, and within each cell is the DNA of the cell that controls production of proteins. Each cell produces different kinds of proteins for different jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so nervous cells are going to be producing proteins to support the nervous system. And so these prions are being produced by specific cells whose job it is to produce them. So I think an infective prion, an abnormal prion, somehow gets into a body and causes those construction cells that are building new prions to make them wrong.
Okay.
How that happens is at the cellular level and genetic level, and I don't know that we know it.
Yet to be fully determined by science.
Yes.
But I bet in the next couple of years we'll have that figured out.
Perhaps.
Not us necessarily,
no,
but
no.
Smart people.
Yes.
Okay, so I guess, Steve, to me, and I want to get back to history. I want to circle back to history in a moment. But when you spoke about the cumulative effect of these prions, some people say prions, it's going to cause this degenerative failure of tissue. And to me, that makes me think of what it's classified as. And CWD is classified as a TSE disease. And here's a mouthful. That's a transmissible spongiform encephalopathy.
Yes, that's a mouthful.
That is a mouthful.
Let's break it down into its pieces and help people understand what TSE is.
TSE, transmissible, spread from animal to animal, or
yes.
Can be.
Mm-hmm.
Spongiform, I'll give that one to you.
Okay. Think of a brain or a spinal column as being a solid mass of tissue. It's normally healthy tissue. It's if you slice it and magnify it, you're going to see a solid mass of cellular structures. Imagine, though, if you took... So take a slice of a steak, and you look at it, and it's a solid mass of tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Now take a slice of a sponge and look at it. And cellularly, looking at the tissue of brain tissue and spinal cord tissue of an advanced case of chronic wasting disease, or TSE, looks not like a solid piece of healthy tissue like a steak. It looks more like a sponge. The cellular structure is degenerating. It's
and
like
hence,
a skeleton of its former self.
Yeah, and so hence the name. That's where the spongiform in TSE comes from.
And then that third term, encephalopathy. Encephalo refers to the head or the brain. And then pathy is just referring to a disease process that causes problems.
Yeah.
So it's transmissible from animal to animal and from the environment to an animal. So animals can catch it from each other or from the environment. It causes this pathology in the brain that's, imagine, creating a sponge from a solid tissue.
Turns your brain to sponge.
Yes.
At least that's how it appears.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Where did it come from? What do we know? From a scientific perspective, what does the evidence best suggest at this point in time with the information we have? Mm-hmm. Where do we think this came from?
Let's talk historically, not about chronic wasting disease, which is what we call it in deer, but let's talk about historical references to this type of disease.
To TSEs.
Mm-hmm. Prion-related diseases have been prevalent, not necessarily as such, but the descriptions of signs and symptoms of diseases in sheep and in humans and in cattle have been documented. Well, the sheep version of TSE goes back a couple of hundred years, back when people first started describing animals with symptoms similar to chronic wasting disease. Back then, they didn't know what prions were. They didn't know about this type of diagnostic capability. They didn't have the diagnostic capabilities we do now. So back then, it was just, these animals are acting like this, and there's some kind of a...
And they appear to be starving, it looks like. They're losing weight. We don't understand it.
Yes, and they're losing their ability to walk, and you know, they're salivating a lot. They have these symptoms and signs. Oh, fun fact.
Okay.
Symptom versus a sign. Did you know the difference?
Well, of course I do, but I don't want to steal the opportunity away from listeners.
Okay, let me, and I just recently learned this fact myself by talking to a very intelligent wildlife pathology veterinarian.
Okay.
I've always interchanged those terms, but mm-hmm. a symptom is technically what a disease is causing an organism to feel that is then described to a doctor. So humans have symptoms because we can talk about them.
Okay.
A sign is what veterinarians used to describe what the symptoms look like in an animal. Because the animal can't say, you know, my joints ache.
Yeah.
That's a symptom that we can describe, but an animal can't say my joints ache, but an animal can walk in a way that a trained eye by a veterinarian can say, that animal's joints hurt.
Yeah.
Based on the signs that it... So...
Interesting trivia.
Yes. So...
I wonder if that'll ever be on Trivial Pursuit.
Probably not.
But if so...
Or Jeopardy. Maybe somebody... Yeah. But anyway, let's get back to the seriousness of our topic here. We may interchange those two terms, but they do mean different things to mm-hmm. a veterinarian versus a medical doctor.
Gotcha.
So these animals, hundreds of years ago, a couple hundred years ago, the sheep had signs that were indicative of CWD, or transmissible encephalopathy, spongiform encephalopathy. It wasn't until more recent, the 1900s, that the disease was actually diagnosed as a TSE type of problem.
And called scrapie in sheep.
Yes. Now, the disease has also been documented in humans for probably 100 years, 80 or 100 years. It's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease in humans, and it was first documented in tribes around the world that are cannibalistic,
mm-hmm.
and when an elder in their tribe dies, they thought that by eating their brain tissue, that would help imbibe them with some of the wisdom and knowledge of that person, and so they would do that. And so this TSE type disease was found in those tribes at a very high rate. And doctors, you know, studied that and described it based on the morphology in the brain as a spongiform encephalopathy. And it was spread by eating the brains of infected animals infected other humans.
Yeah, so they're directly consuming the prion-rich, the infected
yes.
tissue
yes.
directly. Yeah,
and then in... the early 1990s, Britain had an outbreak of what's called mad cow disease.
BSE, not TSE for this one, BSE.
Yeah, bovine spongiform encephalopathy. It's specific to bovids, which are, well, you can answer.
The cow family. Call it the cow
yeah.
family.
Yeah. Animals with horns and hooves mm-hmm. are bovids.
Yeah.
Well, the sheep. Is a within that same bovidae,
mm-hmm.
so we got to be careful because sheep. Yeah, well, BSE.
You're going through your taxonomy aren't you?
I got to be careful what
I say
here
versus the cervidae. Yeah,
but sheep are within the bovidae.
They're
family
within the bovidae,
also.
Right?
But mad cow disease is specifically referred to as bovine spongiform encephalopathy to differentiate it from sheep scrapie. But this outbreak happened in Great Britain in mm-hmm. the early 1990s. And, you know, this was a big issue within the ag community in Great Britain. And there was concern, I think Europe, the mainland of Europe, said, well, we're not going to allow you to ship your beef into Europe, mainland Europe, because you've got this outbreak of BSE.
Mm-hmm.
The British, I believe it was the Minister of Agriculture at the time, actually said, oh, no, this is not a problem. And he actually had a commercial on TV where he and his granddaughter sat eating beef, hamburgers, or some form of beef. Mm-hmm. And it was, don't worry about eating British beef. It's not a problem. It's not transmissible to humans. And subsequent to that, over 200 people have died from mad cow disease because it turns out it was transmissible to humans. It just had not been shown to be transmissible up to that point. Long story.
Yeah.
But
that very event is what makes people very hesitant about CWD, is that we have a very similar disease with this BSE, or mad cow disease. The behavior of that is very similar to CWD. And so us as humans, we're looking at, well, if a cow has something similar to CWD and humans consumed that meat and got Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, or, you know, in that case from mad cow disease, what does it mean for human beings eating venison here? So that's really when we get to the human side of that, Steve, I think that's part of it. That's why it's such a big deal for humans.
Yes.
Are we going to get the disease?
Yes. So maybe we'll talk about that in a few minutes so that we don't get out of context here. We're talking about the history of chronic wasting disease. So we've got it, had it in sheep, got it in cows, the bovid, and in the late 60s, in Colorado, the State Wildlife Agency had some research pens, and they had over several years animals dying of signs that we now know are the sign, classic signs of chronic wasting disease: emaciation, inability to walk, a lot of salivation, aversion to eating. They lose a lot of weight. They'll grind their teeth. You know, they had these symptoms, or signs, and they didn't know what the cause was. Because these signs are not indicative specifically of chronic wasting disease. If you see an emaciated, thin deer in Mississippi or in any other state, it doesn't mean you have chronic wasting disease. What it means is you have an animal that is exhibiting signs that could be CWD. It also could be any number of diseases that cause similar signs.
You know, a real good example for bucks this time of year is a brain abscess.
Yes.
So that's really, really common, that buck's brain is being affected by infection. So, of course, he's not behaving normally.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, that will lead to the demise of that deer. They will die. So yeah, that's exactly right, Steve. You know, and also what was curious about here in Mississippi with the one incident is, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think the cause of death was pneumonia.
That's right.
Severe pneumonia. So if someone were just to do a basic necropsy or autopsy of the deer and didn't specifically test for CWD, one could have easily concluded deer's just sick, died of pneumonia.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And so you have to test, and there's a series of various tests, and we won't get into the technicalities of the different tests, but you have to test specifically for it. So we had these, Colorado Wildlife Agency had these mule deer dying in their pens. And over several years, doing an evaluation of the cause of death, they generalized that these deer are dying of a transmissible spongiform encephalopathy-like process. And then in the early 70s, they designated it as chronic wasting disease. Because, you know, what is chronic wasting? Well, the deer waste away. They mm-hmm. lose weight. Chronic means it takes a long time for it to happen. If an animal literally gets a bad prion in its body, it might be 15, 18 months before it's showing any symptoms of the disease. So it's a chronic, it's a long-term disease process, and it might be another 2 years before the animal actually gets really bad, showing serious signs of the disease, and then either die of it or a secondary cause.
That's a good point. I've been explaining to people Think of influenza and think once you are exposed to that virus, it can be hours and certainly within a day or two, you feel miserable. That's how quickly that virus is growing and affecting your body. So it's really, really a short-term type of infection, whereas chronic wasting disease is, it can be years. The accumulation is just really, really slow. It's not like a fast-moving virus that's taking over your body and shutting things down.
That's right.
It's just, it takes a long time. Again, that's the reason for the word chronic.
So in the early 70s, it was published, these results were published, hey, we have a new disease here. And in the interim, they started looking for it, and they discovered it. Well, actually, they went through an interesting process. They depopulated those research pens, and they said, all right, we have a disease in these pens. We need to depopulate it, clean it out. They literally removed the topsoil. They sprayed it with disinfectant, the fence, and they cleaned it up using normal cleaning procedures to get rid of a disease agent. They put deer back in it, and the deer get sick again. They weren't able to clean the disease agent out of the facility. It's difficult to get rid of or to deactivate the disease agent, these misformed proteins, because it's not alive. It's a piece of protein. It's not a living organism. So if it's not living, it can't really be killed easily.
That's what's so tricky about this versus a living virus or living bacteria. All that stuff can be treated and killed.
Yes.
At least 99.99% of it can. This is almost abiotic. It's almost like a particle or of an element. It's almost like a molecule of phosphorus or a molecule of calcium or something in that regard. But then once it gets into your system, it starts behaving in a way that causes other prions to behave badly.
Yes.
And the cycle starts that way.
And a lot of people, myself included, want to know, well, where did this chronic wasting disease in deer come from? Well, we don't know, and we will never know exactly where it came from. But in the Western Mountain region where it initially was described and has been an epicenter for the spread of the disease, there is historically a lot of sheep ranching. Sheep have been known to have their variety of TSE, scrapie, for a couple hundred years. And so probably there was scrapie prions in the environment in the Western Mountain regions where sheep farming was prevalent, sheep ranching. The mule deer could have gotten it from sheep directly or picked up the prions. And, you know, that the protein, that the prion protein is literally thousands of amino acids that go into building a single protein. Hundreds or thousands. I don't know how many exactly amino acids are in a prion, but think of it as hundreds to thousands of little amino acids. And they're built and formed in a particular structure normally. And then there's the disease agent is the malformed or misfolded or abnormal prion. So it's during the process of protein production, there's some error that happens in the transcription of the amino acids into proteins. And so it could be that the variety, the malformed protein in the sheep, just there became a second version of it. Then that second version happened to be infective to mule deer and also to elk, or to the cervid family. These disease agents change over time. Just like our flu vaccine this year, you know, we've all heard that, you know, the flu vaccine this year wasn't very effective, maybe 25% effective. So if you got the flu vac, if you took the flu vaccine, 25% of the people won't get the flu, but 75% of them will still get the flu.
Yeah.
It's because the flu virus changes from last year to this year. And so the vaccine, the virus that's in causing the flu this year is a little bit different than what it was last year. And that last year's virus is what they built the vaccine on. And so these disease agents, they tweak a little bit. And
they mutate.
They mutate. And so they become infective in a different, slightly different way that the vaccine might not work on. Well, I can think, in my mind, it makes sense that all of these animals that are producing these malformed proteins, the prions, they just mutate a little bit. And now they're in a slightly different form that could be absorbed and infective to a different type of animal.
So you would say, in terms of all the hypotheses, that's the one that you think there's the most evidence for at this point in time? This was probably a jumping from species to species, or maybe a mutation from scrapie.
That's my personal opinion of the information that I've seen and what I understand about cellular physiology and all that stuff. Makes the most sense to me.
Makes the most sense to you, okay.
And it didn't happen like on a Saturday afternoon one day. I mean, the sheep were there for 100 or more years, ranched intensively, some dying from scrapie, and the environment was infected with their prions. And so, you know, there may have been hundreds of mule deer that took in the scrapie prion and nothing ever happened. But it was just that odd sheep that happened to have a slightly different mutation of their prion that became infective to cervids. Now, let's talk about how is it infective. Well, the first stage of a prion becoming infective to a new animal is that it has to be absorbed across from the intestinal tract, stomach or small and large intestines, has to go across that membrane into the animal, be transmitted somehow from that stomach or intestine area up to the nervous system. I may be getting ahead of ourselves here and may be getting too far into the weeds, but one of the classic places we look for chronic wasting disease in deer is the base of the brain, an area called the obex. Why is that one of the go-to places for CWD to be tested for? Well, coincidentally, the nerves that run from the intestinal tract to the brain, a lot of them enter the brain at the obex. And so it's, you know, if you think about these prions getting into nerve cells and then causing those nerve cells to create malformed prions, and then those prions are kind of shifted up the nervous system up into the brain. And so the obex is one of the first places that these malformed prions show up and can be documented.
Okay. I had always wondered that, why that was and lymphatic tissue, correct?
Yeah, lymphatic tissue is the cleaning portion of the body. It's processing bad stuff, and so bad things tend to accumulate in the lymph nodes, and so the other go-to, and in fact now the prioritized tissue to sample is the retropharyngeal lymph nodes, because it's a easily removed and relatively easily and relatively cheaply tested place for prions to show up, the malformed prions.
Okay, let's let's revisit this. We touched on it a few minutes ago. Why is this a big deal, Steve? I'd love to hear your opinion on the deer side. What can CWD do to a deer herd? And then maybe we revisit the human element of this. So let's start with deer. Is there evidence geographically where, whether it be whitetails or mule deer, that have known that this was a CWD area? What's it done to the herd dynamics and the population?
Okay. It's a chronic wasting disease, so it's a long-term it takes a long time for the disease to harm an individual. If it's slow acting on the individual level, then it's probably slow acting at the population level. It spreads relatively slowly. In the areas that have had it for 30 or 40 years, like the mountainous West, Colorado, Wyoming, those states have areas of very high prevalence, 30%, 40% prevalence in a population.
I got to stop you right there, Steve. Define prevalence.
Okay, prevalence is the number of tested animals that have a disease. So if it's a 30% prevalence, that means if you test 100 animals, 30 of them will be shown to have the disease. So 30% prevalence is a high prevalence. That means, well, let's talk, why is it important to the deer? Every deer that gets it is going to die from chronic wasting disease if it doesn't die of something else first. So if 30% of the deer population has the malformed prions, 30% of the deer population will die of CWD if they live long enough. And Western big game management, elk and mule deer, their main goal in Western management systems is to produce mature animals for trophy harvest. And so they allow, their management is designed to allow older animals to, you know, for bucks and bulls to live longer. And so in their populations, they designed to have older animals, they have animals dying of CWD directly or indirectly from other diseases where the CWD predisposes them to die from. So the animals that have CWD live less long than animals that don't have CWD. So in long-term studies, there have been cases where mule deer populations have declined by 50% over a 30-year period because of chronic wasting disease.
Devil's advocate a little bit here. We can't say that's going to happen in every scenario, because the way I think about it, Steve, is how quickly or the extent of a deer population decline is going to depend on recruitment.
Absolutely.
And so if you have a population, you're in an area, good habitat, lots of food, et cetera, and the recruitment rate is very high, I could envision there being less of an impact in terms of the deer population.
Absolutely. And the harvest system that the deer population is managed under is really important. Yeah. One of our population dynamics terms we refer to is turnover rate of the population. So out west, they're targeting mature animals for harvest. Their turnover rate is slow. And so older animals are going to show the disease and die from it. In some areas of the United States, in the eastern in particular, the turnover rate is very high. Bucks in particular might be living only 2 or 3 years before they're harvested. And in that kind of situation, if you have a high turnover rate, the disease doesn't have the opportunity to impact the survival of individual deer because they're harvested before they would have died from the disease.
Let's talk about the female side of it too. In an area that has high reproductive rate, fecundity, especially of young females, then that can certainly affect this outcome as well. So if you're in an area where a doe will never successfully raise a fawn until she's 3 or more years of age, I could see CWD having a greater impact. But if you're in a place like in Mississippi or other productive places where yearlings can be having fawns, and certainly all 2-year-old does are successfully raising fawns, then again, because of the chronic nature of it, it's not affecting them yet. It's not affecting that reproductive age class yet.
That's right. Yep. So the potential impact to the deer population depends on, there's our favorite word, it depends. But it depends on reproductive success or recruitment into the population of young animals, and then the turnover rate. Think harvest rate of animals within the population. If you have a high turnover rate, you're not going to see much of an impact because animals are harvested before they die naturally of the disease.
So here's the answer. Will it affect the deer herd? It depends.
It depends.
The answer is it depends. Our favorite wiggle word or phrase, it depends. Okay, humans. Why do humans care?
Humans care because they know that mad cow disease kills humans. Chronic wasting disease is similar to mad cow disease. Chronic wasting disease has not been shown to kill anyone yet. No human has been diagnosed that died from the human case that was obtained by eating venison. Has not been proven yet. It has been shown that monkeys fed deer meat that was containing the infective prions did contract the disease. It's been shown that a very limited number of sample pigs that were fed infected meat contracted the disease. So it is possible for other mammals besides deer to contract the prion, the TSE disease, from eating venison. It has not been shown that humans can contract TSE from eating venison.
There's not enough evidence yet to say definitively yes or no.
That's right.
So what we are using is evidence that we have with similar diseases in similar species, and saying, given what we have, given the evidence we have, we should be concerned. I know I am. I would certainly pause and think, I'm showing concern here.
It's prudent to be worry about what you're eating and what your family is eating.
Yeah. And that is essentially what the CDC has said as well.
Yes.
In that light, too. So certainly they do not advise, the very clear case, they say, if you're in an area that's had CWD and you can have that animal tested and it is positive, don't eat it.
That's right.
That's pretty clear. Yeah. Okay, Steve, we're making every effort, to keep this on the shorter side. So I've got a couple questions for you, and then I think we'll be at a place where we can wrap up, and we will do a follow-up episode with other questions. But so as part of our state wildlife agency, the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks, as soon as the news broke, by executive order, it was stop all supplemental feeding, baiting, etc. in this containment zone or the hot zone. And in Mississippi, that turned out to be a 6-county area where this individual was identified, the CWD positive deer. What's the big deal? Why stop supplemental feeding? Does supplemental feeding cause CWD?
Absolutely not. A malformed prion causes the disease, to the best of our understanding. That malformed prion can be shed in saliva, in urine. And so if you have a deer that's carrying the disease, it's a chronic disease. It takes a while before the animal ultimately dies. So over several years, an animal is sick and carrying infective prions and shedding them in saliva and urine. So it's walking across the landscape shedding these bad prions. And when it walks up to a feeder, sticks its mouth into a trough, however the feeder is dispensing the food, its saliva is getting on that feeder and into the feed. And then another deer comes up and eats that feed or licks that feeder and is exposed to the bad prions. So it's not about causing the disease not to be there. It's about reducing the rate of spread of the disease if it is there.
Yeah, the supplemental feeding, baiting, etc. I just want to be very clear about that. It's not causing the disease. It is when you have it in your population, it facilitates the spread of it.
That's
you
right.
increase the probability or the odds of it being the first part of TSE is transmissible. You increase the odds of transmission when you concentrate those animals at a feeding source.
Yes.
Okay. I'm glad we got that addressed. All right. So, number two, having captive deer, does that cause CWD?
No. Now, the captive cervid, they refer to themselves as an industry. The captive cervid industry, or individuals that have breeding pens, and in some states they're allowed to buy and sell live animals. And in most states where they exist, even if they can't bring in or buy and sell live animals, they are still allowed to buy semen and potential, you know, male reproductive material in little tubes that are frozen, and they bring them in and they can artificially inseminate females within their breeding pens to manipulate intensively the genetic composition of the offspring being produced. And so you're bringing in semen and historically live animals. Now, the best way to transmit a disease agent is in any medium that facilitates its existence. Well, the best medium for a disease agent is a live animal. That is
an infected live animal.
And so it's been clearly documented in a number of cases that chronic wasting disease was moved from one place to another by shipping live animals that were chronically infected. It takes a long time to show a sign that it has a disease. And back when this disease was first being documented, the testing procedures weren't even evaluated. We didn't necessarily know how best to test for the disease. We knew if an animal died from it, you could look in histologically in a microscope and see, yeah, this deer died of it. But the testing procedures were even undeveloped at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a lot of live animal shipments, some of it by actual state agencies that were trying to do their best to facilitate cervid, you know, cervid being deer or elk management.
Yeah. Restocking efforts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they inadvertently transported live animals that had the disease, or allowed the deer breeding industry to ship animals that they didn't know at the time had the disease. So live animal shipment is a potential problem. And typically within breeding pens, you have supplemental feeding, and you have that high concentration of animals, which are conducive to spreading a disease. So if you bring one animal into a breeding enclosure and it has the disease, it's going to share it with the other animals in that pen very readily, because they're all eating out of the same feeder and they're in close confinement. And
then because of the chronic nature, as you've alluded to several times, an infected deer simply becomes a carrier. They're not symptomatic, or they're not showing signs, because they're living for years, often, with
yes.
this. And because there's no really good, if any, live animal test right now, those deer can easily be shipped from point A to point B, unbeknownst to the person shipping those animals, that they have just shipped the deer along with the disease to a new location.
Yes, and the classic case is back from the early 80s when some elk were shipped from the United States into Canada. Legally, live animal, you know, somebody sold some elk that they had in a facility into Canada. The animals looked healthy. Veterinarians do a live animal evaluation before it can be shipped, and vets said animals look healthy. Animals were shipped into Canada. The elk breeding facility in Canada had them for a number of years. They bred them. They then sold some of those animals to other breeders in Canada, and then sold animals that were just in the pen with those animals to other breeders. And then some of those breeders sold animals to other, third-party breeder. And so over a 5 or 6 year period before they realized that some of the initial elk had chronic wasting disease, there were over 20 different breeding facilities that had deer one way or the other that had been exposed to chronic wasting disease. So all of those facilities had to be depopulated.
Okay, Steve, we've discussed the transmissible part from a live animal perspective, transmission from animal to animal. What's another way? Is there an environmental influence we need to be concerned about?
Absolutely. We have these prions that literally are non-living, and they don't die. Once they're present in the environment, they can be ingested by other animals from the environment. We know that prions brought in the carcass of a harvested deer or elk can carry the infected prions, and if an animal is brought in, or just the head and, you know, part of the neck, like traditional, you know, if you shoot an elk or a mule deer out west back in the 80s before the distribution was fully understood and the concerns were fully understood. You know, somebody goes from Mississippi to Colorado or Wyoming, shoots an elk or a mule deer, brings it back, processes it here, takes the skeleton and dumps it out in the woods, or maybe they bring just the boned out meat, but they bring part of the neck and the head back and take it to the taxidermist to cape it out. And that taxidermist has now cut off the top of the brain case, but then they discard the brain and the upper part of the neck that has all these prions in it, potentially. And where do those go? Well, they go out potentially into the environment and exist there. As the animal's parts decompose over time, those prions, which are, think, you know, like your analogy, it's almost like a mineral. It gets into the soil, and it's been shown that prions can be picked up by a plant. Just like they pick up nitrogen, phosphorus, calcium from the soil, plants pick up infected prions, and then an animal can eat that plant and then get the prion.
Yeah, that has been demonstrated in a lab. That's been proven that mechanism of uptake is possible. We all have our fingers crossed that in the real world it's not very likely, but it has certainly been demonstrated that it's possible. And I know in one of the meetings we were at recently, Steve, some people were talking about it, depending on the soil type you're at, and maybe depending on the amount of clay and the charge of those soil particles, mm-hmm. maybe the prions will be bound. Yeah. And cannot be. But the mechanism has been proven that is possible to happen.
That's right.
And that is absolutely devastating to me when I think about it.
Yeah, once you've got it.
You got it forever and ever.
You've got it.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why people have been so serious about this over the years, and why you don't want this in your state.
That's right.
Because when you got it, you got it. Okay, well, Steve, let's wrap up with once you have it. We have some examples of different states where, because of testing and because of good fortune, the outcomes have kind of been different. You want
right.
to give us a few from, I think, of New York as an example, and our neighbors in Arkansas as an example.
Yeah, those are two extreme cases.
Yeah.
New York was lucky in that they found it early, really early. They found it only in a few animals, and apparently they removed the few animals that were actually sick with it, the carriers. And they have not found it in subsequent years of testing, pretty intensive testing. Now, in theory, the prions were shed by those infected animals and are still out there. So they might find it in an animal next week or next year or 5 years from now. But for the last few years, they haven't found any more cases. That's a best case scenario. We hope here in Mississippi that's our situation. Most states, when they find it, they don't find the first animal to have gotten sick from it. The case there is Arkansas. When they discovered it in the first two animals, they found it in an elk, they found it in a whitetail, almost simultaneously. And then they said, you know, they established their containment area around those two animals and started sampling intensively. And they found it in about 20% or more of their samples. High prevalence. Like, oh my goodness, this has been here a long time, because it's a chronic disease at the individual level, and it's not highly infective like the flu. It doesn't just spread, you know, rampantly through the population. It takes a while to build up. So to get to a population prevalence of 20%, you're talking about 10 or 15 years it's been there. And so Arkansas doesn't have the rosy outcome that New York has. They've got it. They're probably not going to get rid of it. They have to live with it.
Yeah. So they move into the strategy of, we got it, we need to cope with it, and now it's management, really. Management of their lifestyles, management of hunting and what they do, continued management of surveillance over the years, and and it'll be adaptive management, I'm sure. Every single year, they'll use the information they got the year before and modify and go forward.
That's right.
In a positive way.
And that's a really involved, complex story that I think we can talk about in a future podcast.
Yeah, we will, Steve, and as we started, we're going to go through the Mississippi experience, and someone in New Hampshire may not care as much about our experience, but I think it's going to be good if we kind of chronicle these steps, and we hope within a week or two, MDWFMP will be implementing their action plan. So they're going to be determining, based on their samples, what is the prevalence rate, and that's going to guide the future. That's going
right.
to guide sampling. What is the prevalence rate? What are the dangers? What things, you know, are Mississippians going to have to modify?
You know, thinking about our audience and people listening in from different states or countries, why should they care to listen to these podcasts about chronic wasting disease? Well, you're either in a state that has it, or you're in a state or a country that likely will get it, because it has been moving across the United States and North America. It has been spreading over time. Started out, it was just in Colorado, and now it's in, counting Mississippi, 25 states, two or three provinces in Canada. If you don't have it, you very well may get it eventually.
Well, let me add to that. How about caribou now in Norway?
That's
confirmed.
Right. Absolutely.
And I want to say, Steve, is the other country South Korea?
Yes.
So there you go. Globally, this is happening.
That was a case in South Korea where a live animal was brought in.
Mm-hmm.
Brought the disease into South Korea.
Case in point, with live animals. Okay, Steve, I think we will wrap up there. Hey, I enjoyed it, man. It's been a while. It's been right at 2 months, and I'm ashamed of that. So we will pick up the pace. But thank you for your time, and we'll do it again soon.
Absolutely.
We're glad you joined us today, and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.